With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week, Caroline Crampton talks to George Eaton and Raphael Baer about rebellious Tory backbenchers, Philip Maughan talks to Caroline and Kate Mossman about why Taylor Swift isn't just for tweenagers, and Ian Steadman and I discuss the possibility that your house might be swallowed by a giant sinkhole.
I'm here with Raphael Baer, our political editor, and George Eaton, the editor of the Staggers blog, to talk about the things that they've both written in the magazine, Raph about the Tories and George about Labour. We'll start with Raph's cover story, which has got the headline Captive Cameron, and about how David Cameron's sort of being held prisoner by different elements of his party. What's that about, Raph?
Well, yes, the starting point really is the observation that David Cameron will be fighting the next election, he would hope on a platform saying everything has worked, it's fine, maybe it caused a little bit of pain, but things are pointing in the right direction, stick with us. And this is historically a classic electoral proposition. It's sort of more of the same versus change has been essentially the dividing line in every election ever. The interesting thing is that coalition slightly changes that. It's one of the ways that coalition really destroys British political precedent, is that there is no one party that will be campaigning in the next election on a pure more of the same prospectus. Yeah. Because actually the Conservatives are deeply dissatisfied with Cameron personally, but also with the compromises that have been made with the Liberal Democrats. And also through that frustration, they've acquired a much more aggressive, puritanical, ideological commitment to drastic change. And they see the austerity that has been contained in George Osborne's budgets and spending reviews as really just the baseline, the starting point for a more ferocious assault on all the apparatus of British government that we've inherited from the 20th century, whether that's the civil service, the welfare state, the membership of the European Union. And what this means ultimately is that David Cameron is very hard now to see what his offer will actually be at the next election, when he is the sort of par excellence candidate of steady as she goes, more of the same.
Yeah.
And actually everyone else will be saying, including many Tories, will be campaigning on there's time for a change. I don't mean to say by that Cameron can't win. I think it's hard to call, but you know, there's every likelihood that he might be Prime Minister again after 2015. It's just extremely hard to see how he survives much beyond that. It's very hard to see what the prospectus is that will really make people think, yes, what we really need is David Cameron for another 5 years as Prime Minister, because actually a lot of Tories don't want that.
And these turbo Thatcherites, as I believe you termed them in the piece, what are they doing to try and manoeuvre the Conservatives in the direction they want them to go?
Well, you have to distinguish a little bit between people who are frustrated with David Cameron but recognise that he's easily their best chance, the Tories' best chance of being re-elected, and just sort of want to tug him to the right, and they do that in various ways, but obviously pushing more aggressively towards a Brexit position on the European Union, in other words, legitimising the idea that there's nothing to fear from Britain leaving the EU, and then that should in fact be a mainstream Conservative position. I think they're making a lot of progress on that. They would also probably a lot of them want tax cuts and a much more aggressive effort to reduce spending and bring the debt down faster than is currently foreseen. beyond them, there is a kernel of people who actually want to sabotage David Cameron. Now, we don't know how many of them there are. Estimates are probably, there might not be more than around 30 MPs. But that's actually quite a lot of people who sort of think that David Cameron losing will be good and healthy for the Conservative Party, because then you have a disastrous Ed Miliband
that's
government.
That's almost
as they
enough
sit.
For a leadership challenge, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And certainly I would be flatly amazed if a leadership challenge occurs before the next election. Yeah. I do think, though, that there are enough people who want to see David Cameron fail that you, and pretty much certainly until the May European parliamentary elections and beyond, you will see this constant, these constant ripples of disruption and disorder in the Conservative ranks. I think if you get, if the Tories manage to push Labour down or pull Labour back in the polls to something like parity, indicating that their, you know, economic recovery is giving them an electoral dividend, the Tories will then start to shut up a little bit and Labour will start to look nervous, and then the dynamic will change. If Labour can hold their lead further into the year, into the autumn, possibly towards the end of the year, then I think you're in looking at a situation where the Conservatives go into a kind of their own panicky meltdown. Obviously, it's hard to call.
George, you've written in the magazine about Labour this week. What do you make of that? Do you think it's a possibility Labour can hold steady, as it were?
Hold steady in terms of...
In terms of their poll ratings, in terms of not letting the Tories win the argument, as Ralph described.
Yeah, it's there are a few sort of nervous people in Labour ranks. The polls have been narrowing, so you know Labour's poll lead has sort of roughly halved at the end of last year, from about 11 points in 2012 to about 6. And now you're getting 5s and 4s, which is a little too close to comfort, given that the recovery is obviously going to continue to accelerate. The big two trends to watch, of course, as ever, are how many 2010 Lib Dems can Labour hold on to. And how many 2010 Tory voters can UKIP hold on to? It's always worth remembering, you know, Labour can win big on quite a small lead, as they did in 2005. But I think, so 15 months out from an election, you'd probably want to be a bit more than or 5 points ahead in the polls.
And you've written this week about this this difference between sort of good borrowing and bad borrowing, and how a lot of the things Labour say they want to do, house building, better welfare state, all this kind of stuff, costs money. And yet they won't commit to saying we would have to spend money. It's this kind of interesting catch-22 they've got themselves into. Is that something that they're going to feel even more worried about doing, given that the polls have narrowed like they are?
I think so. I think because the Conservatives have extended their lead on the economy, voters have always believed that cuts are necessary, and also blamed Labour for the cuts more than the Tories. But now there's evidence that they even think cuts have been good for the economy. And so Labour hasn't even attempted to make the case explicitly for borrowing to invest, despite the fact that, as you suggest, if you want a mass house building programme, if you want universal childcare, these things cost money. And in fiscally constrained times, the only way to pay for them is to borrow. And so I've spoken to some MPs in the party who do want Ed Miliband and Ed Balls to be upfront about this now and to try to reframe the debate. And so to start using sort of the Tories' household analogies against them. So, for instance, it does make sense for an individual to borrow to take out a mortgage in certain circumstances, particularly if the payments are lower than their rent. It makes sense to borrow to buy a car if it means you can travel to a job that pays more than your current one. There are people in Labour who think that argument can be won, and that the party needs to start making it now rather than a few months before the general election suddenly announcing, yes, we are going to borrow.
Yes, I think that George is absolutely right that Labour need to now decontaminate the idea of borrowing to invest. And I think the problem that they have, and I feel the penny is now starting to drop on this one in senior Labour circles, that they can't make that argument when people think that they are still lax on current spending. And looking back on it, I think the feeling is that they really did need earlier to make clear that they recognised that there was a trade-off between your day-to-day spending, the money going on things like housing benefit, which are very unpopular, which isn't terribly productive. A lot of it goes into the pockets of landlords, so that you then have the capacity to do all this other, you know, healthy, productive spending. And to borrow George's analogy, that the problem that Labour will have is when they say, well, yes, you need to borrow money so you can get a car to get to another job, the sort of counter argument is, yes, but if you then borrow that money to get a car and you're also maxing out your credit card to spend it all on booze and fags, then that's actually not a very good way to run your affairs. And so Labour really need, I think there's this line that's been around, is that Labour needs to sort of take out a fiscal puppy and shoot it. You know, something that people will suddenly make it clear they understand that there are going to be serious sacrifices in the current spending. And the problem is, if they'd done that earlier on, they would be on firmer ground. Now that puppy's grown into a nice, happy, you know, Labrador that, you know, licks their hands and makes them feel loved and appreciated, and it's all that harder to shoot.
Is this an issue of, I think we've talked before about the fact that Labour, and particularly Ed Miliband's project, he lacks outriders. He lacks the people who are willing to go on TV and float the more extreme versions of the idea so that he can move into the space.
In fairness, I don't think there's been a shortage of people on the Labour side saying you need to demonstrate that you get it on current spending and fiscal rigour. I don't think there have been many people saying, because you can therefore win an argument on borrowing. And I think if those people had made that argument more clearly, they might have got more of a hearing. I think the problem has been more that, you know, in order to hold the party together, it has been in the culture of the Labour Party very, very difficult to tell people they things they don't particularly want to hear in terms of what a tight current spending fiscal settlement actually feels like for Labour people and Labour voters.
And another difference that's opened up a little bit between the parties this year, this week, is on the issue of women, and particularly women at the top of politics. You mentioned in your piece, Raf, that the Tories are suffering a small exodus of female MPs standing down at PMQs this week. Ed Miliband made the visual point that the Tory front bench didn't contain any women unlike his own. Is that something about the Conservative culture that's turning women away?
I'm not an expert on being
but I do know.
I think it is, and although the counter argument you get from the Conservative side is, well, look, actually lots of Labour women are standing down too, that's a dead end for the sort of intellectual cul-de-sac.
When you haven't got so many in the first place, yeah.
Clearly Labour are streets ahead in terms of getting women represented in Parliament, and certainly there isn't that mood around the Labour Party as there is around the Conservative Party, that a bunch of angry white men are defining what the party is. In the piece, I describe it as a kind of coagulation of conservatism. It's not fluid, it's not open, it's becoming hard and shriveled. And that is, it might be enough in terms of mobilising certain arguments effectively to get them over the finish line in an election, but culturally, it really suggests a party in quite serious decline for the long term. And the sensible people in the Conservative Party know that and they're very worried about it.
Now, George, did it strike you this week that that was an effective line of attack for Ed Miliband? I mean, I know I've talked quite a bit, Helen Lewis, our deputy editor, has written quite a lot about the lack of women in Ed Miliband's backroom team, but his front bench is really quite equal gender-wise.
It is, and having Harriet Harman as deputy leader has helped, and Miliband has made this commitment to have nearly half of his shadow cabinet as women throughout his leadership. And of course Labour have all women shortlists. I mean, that is the big difference between them, the Lib Dems and the Tories. That obviously the debate goes on as to whether they're right in principle, but I think everyone recognises that they have secured an increase in female representation that would have been unthinkable otherwise.
It's an ends versus means debate, isn't it? It does achieve getting more women in Parliament, whether you believe the means are right or not.
Yeah, and I mean,
at
PMQs, I mean, they quite deliberately made sure that there were a lot of women on the front bench. Everyone was wondering why the Labour front bench was so crowded that day. And they had 10 women on the Labour front bench and compared to 9 men. And then Miliband was going to make the point, you know, had planned in advance to make the point, look, there are only one or two women on the Tory front. It turned out that there were none.
They and walked into his trap, yeah.
I think Maria Miller walked into the House about 20 past 12, perhaps having been sort of hurriedly summoned by the whips.
You'd love to read that text message, wouldn't you? Get into the chamber, there are no women on the front bench.
But I think the pictures were terrible for the Tories on the 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock news, which is where most voters see PMQs if they see it at all. I think the Tories do have a problem with women voters. It used to be that they had more women voters than male voters, but now I checked the most recent YouGov poll, Labour has a 9-point lead among women compared to just a 3-point lead among men. I mean, that is a problem.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, George. Thanks, Raf.
Thank you.
I'm joined by our arts editor, Kate Mossman, and the editor of a New Statesman website, Caroline Crampton, to talk about Taylor Swift, who is everyone's favourite teen pop sensation, even if you're not a teenager. Kate, I believe you recently saw Taylor in action at the O2, and were rather surprised by the demographic.
Yeah, I did. She's established a sort of residency in the O2 by doing, I think, 5 nights over 11
like
days. It's amazing, yeah. I last saw her when she was 19, although, to be fair, she always sort of feels about 30.
She's always looked so old, hasn't she?
Yeah,
for her age.
Six foot tall, yeah. Very kind of such poise and, I suppose, a certain amount of grace. But yeah, I last saw her, she was 19, and the audience was comprised mostly of 14-year-olds. And the audience this year was a lot younger in some ways, and also had a hell of a lot more people about sort of 35 with their fists in the air. All saying, I mean, friends of mine who went were saying sort of, no, I'm not being ironic, I really, really like her. And I just thought it was very funny that so many adults are saying, no, there's no joke here, we really like Taylor Swift.
Why do you think that is?
I think that there's a big question, but I think there's an escapism in the music that appeals to the older thing.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You get so the little 8-year-olds who are going along with the pink cowboy hats and the slash of red lipstick in the front are sort of, you know, seeing this woman as a potential big sister, a Disney princess, you know, your advisor, your life advisor. And I think people of my age who are going are thinking, wow, I wish I was a teenager. The way this woman parcels this world out with all its romance and its purity, it has a very sort of simplified view of what the sadnesses are of growing up. There's nothing about spots and, feeling fat and hating your gym class. It's more about the fact that your dad won't let you see that boy who's in love with you. And, you know, when I was 15, there weren't any boys in love with me. Kind of like the idea that in Taylor Swift's world, no, they are. It's all perfect. You know, you'll go to that prom, you'll get picked up in that car, and you'll be proposed to on the front porch.
Yeah, by Jake Gyllenhaal.
Exactly.
I mean, this is a strange thing. I mean, you know, Taylor Swift has had a pretty high-profile selection of trysts over the last few years. How does she manage to speak to the every girl? Other than, I mean, her look is so, you know, utterly every girl, but why do people buy it? What is it about her?
It must be the sort of the psychodramas that she is laying out in the songs, sort of deconstructing feelings of disappointment and hope mingled with reality, and also a certain amount of being an individual. So she was famously not very popular at school because the reality was that she was focused on being a pop star. So she might say, oh, I was terribly skinny and gawky and ugly and no one fancied me. But the truth was that she went to Nashville at the age of 14 and got a songwriting contract. And, you know, if you are like that, then there's no time for anything else.
That makes me think of one of her earlier videos from a few years ago when she was sort of dressed up like a band, that she was in a band, and she was wearing sort of big dorky glasses, and she didn't even need to take them off for you to see how perfect her face was underneath. It was sort of like, it was like this geekiness or kind of loserdom was like a prop that she could put on, and I found that completely attractive. Like,
yeah.
Even now, I sort of thought, oh, I wish this had existed like 15 years ago.
There was a very strange sort of part of the set on the last tour that she did where she would sort of have these big reveals that were beamed up onto the monitors of having gone back to school and humiliated the boy who didn't fancy her or the girl that was rude to her. And they were played by actors. And there was a kind of a mass screaming session when someone would be, you know, found in a locker room to have upset her in the past, and then she's sort of like show them up on camera. And she has grown out of that now. There's no there's none of that, but she does do an awful lot of talking down to the audience, which I just found the one thing about the show that just made me want to bang my head into the wall was that she'll be doing this brilliantly slick set and then she'll step forward and go, I get the feeling that there are loads of creative people here, whether it's writing in your journal or picking up a banjo like me and writing a song and stuff, and you're thinking, you don't need this, just get on with the show because the kids love it anyway. Mm. And that was the one point when all the adults standing in this 15,000 strong arena were just shaking their heads and going, oh, actually, this isn't that good at all.
Yeah, that's what I can't quite get my head around, if I'm perfectly honest. And there are enough lyrics that you could, you know, pick out in abstract and say, I mean, this is truly terrible, obnoxious stuff. You know, and I say that as a fan.
Yeah, exactly. So you're doing it now. So
yeah, no, exactly. But for me, it's purely that there's such catchy pop songs.
Yeah.
And it's no more complicated than that. I have zero desire to ever see her in the O2, if I'm perfectly honest. But, you know, I read a big, long profile of her in New York magazine, and the writer talked about things like, so she was doing her set, you know, and it was sort of real tour de force stuff, pyrotechnics, theatricality. And then she said, oh, I'm really sorry, I have to run off and blow my nose.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Do you think this
That's the problem. And I like, in a way, I like how awful this part of the show is, because it shows there's no one advising her properly.
Yeah.
And that suggests that she really is this kind of amazing Brunhilde sort of ego force that she manages herself as well. There isn't really anyone pushing her around very much, so she's allowed to make these ridiculous oversights and misjudgments, which you can still see her making at the same time as being a brilliant performer. Mm. So it's sort of weirdly comforting that she gets things so
really
wrong.
I really like that about her as well, actually, because I perhaps naively think that if she did have a kind of whole team behind her, there'd be none of the kind of costumes you see her wearing now. It would all be kind of tiny shorts and boob tubes and sort of very sexualized videos. The fact that she doesn't really go, she does a bit, but she doesn't really go in for that yet, suggests that she's just gone, I don't really fancy it, I'm just going to do long floaty dresses and long gloves.
I'm not comfortable with a cleavage I'm just going
to
do this.
Well, on that, is she for a different audience to sort of the Miley Cyrus, you know, because you have the pop stars who are going down a reel of looking to create controversy and have, you know, like such as YouTube videos and whatever. Taylor Swift is wholesome, no?
Yeah, she's, well, the sort of chastity of it is very much part of the power, I
yes
think.
The Telegraph were very keen on her, I noticed.
Yeah, that, maybe
they,
that's,
they said she's nothing like that disastrous,
it's so
Miley
easy,
Cyrus,
isn't it, to say that this is the critic's darling thing, is it's so easy to just latch on someone and say, well, she doesn't show her breasts, therefore she's a serious musician. And she's not really, I mean, she's a really good songwriter and she's committed, but there's not a great depth to her music that you don't hear in Katy Perry or Lady Gaga. I mean, they all sort of, to a certain extent, have a pool of songwriters. Taylor Swift always co-writes. But, you know, we'll look back on these songs in 20 or 30 years' time and they'll feel much of a kind. They sound similar in a way. She just happens to have the country element. She doesn't overdo it on the production. There's always a bit of banjo and there's some very, very romantic lyrics rather than sort of the breast beating and the two fingers all the time. I think there's not that much difference at all, but it's the presentation and the committedness of that sort of Disney princess chastity thing, along with the sort of bitch side, which she can do very well. I think that's what's getting through to people.
And you allude to the fact that she's rumoured to be playing Joni Mitchell in a biopic in the future. And, you know, I, once again, as a fan, I would just... my feeling is that I really hope to God that doesn't happen. I think that would be a deep travesty. I think that would be a terrible thing for all of us.
I have mixed feelings about it because I was horrified when I first found that out. But I think apart from Joni Mitchell, Swift is the only person that I can think of who generates momentum for her songs by the end of relationships, moving through them all the time and then writing about them. And I do think it's interesting. I mean, Joni Mitchell is above and beyond Taylor Swift in every way. But, you know, 30 years ago, people wouldn't have been sitting there going, oh, she can't hold down a real relationship. What's she writing these songs about? Mm. Because songwriting is songwriting. And if it gives you energy to write about the end of a relationship to the point where maybe you don't actually sustain one in adult life for quite a long period because you're a songwriter, that's in the territory of songwriting.
And I suppose you could say, perhaps aimlessly, that is there that much difference between Joni Mitchell sort of hanging around on a Greek island and writing songs like Carrie about her doomed relationship there and Taylor Swift writing songs about Harry Styles, you know?
Yeah.
They are sort of a genre, even if one is better than the other.
Yeah, it's one of the great sort of music cliches, isn't it? You can't write songs if you're happy.
Mm.
So I'm sure that Taylor Swift is in bouts of anxiety all the time about what happens if I meet the man of my dreams and have a baby. I'm going to stop being able to write songs that sell to teenagers.
Adele said that as well, hasn't she? That her two sort of award-winning albums each was about the end of a very significant relationship that she had, and now she's married and she's got a kid and stuff. I've not really heard much from her in the last 12 months.
Just to finish, can you explain what Taylor Swift's Who Me face is?
Oh, this is terrible. It's very, very well trodden ground in a sense, but it has to be because it's just so wrong and it's one of these things she needs to lose. But again, because she hasn't lost it, you think, interesting, no advisors. When I first saw her, she created a kind of fever pitch hysteria in the crowd at the point of the applause by the camera focusing right in on her face while she does a, "What? You're clapping for me?" expression of surprise, and because she doesn't say anything to stop the applause, it just grows and grows and grows. And if your audience is 12, they're very good at getting hysterical and practically vomiting with excitement. So she didn't just do that at the end of the show this time, but she does it in between songs as well, and it's very much part of her thing. And there is an internet meme of her, various clips from award shows that have just been put together under the name Taylor Swift looking surprised, and it's not genuine at all, but it's weirdly lovable.
Something adolescent, though. Is something teenagery
very
about
adolescent,
that.
Very adolescent. Okay.
Well, I think I'm going to go
dramatic.
Practice my Who Me face in the loo. Thanks, Kate. Thanks, Caroline.
I'm joined by our science and tech blogger Ian Steadman to talk about sinkholes.
Mm.
First of all, Ian, who or what is a sinkhole?
A sinkhole is a hole in the ground. But
right. Could you give us more detail?
It's when a hole forms underground and then the surface falls into it. You asked me to look into this because of what happened in the news last week with a family in High Wycombe, which is just outside London. This woman woke up to go ready for work and looked out her window and said, "That's funny. My car's not there," and then went to her front door, and there was a big hole in the front yard where the car was, and the car was at the bottom. You couldn't see it, apparently. And this happens quite a lot.
This is what I find fascinating about this: is that once you start looking into this, this isn't an uncommon occurrence, both in places that have generally much more exciting geological and weather things than us.
Oh, yeah.
But in Britain, it happens relatively.
Oh, it does.
But is it like a bit like earthquakes? Are little ones happening?
Oh yeah, all the time, all the time. Well, High Wycombe itself is, there's this big sort of chalky strata that runs underneath the ground there, and chalk is also, along with limestone, they're kind of the culprits here because they dissolve in water really readily. So say you have a river that goes underground into an aquifer, or you have a leaky pipe. This often happens in developing countries which can't afford good plumbing, where you get sort of potholes which are really sinkholes under the roads because piping's burst.
Well, you
whatever.
Say it happens in developing countries, but I seem to remember that Thames Water loses loads. Thousands and thousands of gallons of water out of its pipes because it's essentially relying on a lot of times on Victorian people when they had proper engineers. Do you think?
Yeah. Proper engineers, yeah. But it happens. I mean, in America, it's a particularly bad problem in Florida, which has gained itself the nickname the Swiss cheese state, because they have something. I believe it was 15,000 potholes were recorded in 2013 alone, which is, I mean, most of those are quite small and are probably just pothole size, but they do swallow up houses. There was a guy who died in a pothole. His from the outside his house looked normal, but when you went inside, the entire bedroom was just gone, sort of 20 feet underground.
That's kind of fascinating. They're so localized in a sense that a whole bit of just everything underneath in a relatively narrow corridor can just drop out, presumably. But there's a nice side to sinkholes
there
as well.
This
is what I liked about the piece you wrote in the magazine, is that you sort of started waxing quite lyrical about underwater forests and stuff like that.
They can be quite nice and weird. There's the one in Venezuela where it's in the rainforest, but because these things are 200 meters below the surface, these giant almost craters at the bottom, they have their own rainforest ecosystems which are kind of separated from one above, and they're quite interesting to study. This is something I didn't know until I was researching this piece, is that the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs 700 million years ago,
which fell in Mexico, right?
Yeah, on what is now the Yucatan Peninsula. It's like sort of half on what is now land and half in what is the Gulf of Mexico. But the bit that's on land now, there is an extraordinarily large number of sinkholes in that area because the asteroid changed the geology of the area. They're called cenotes or kenotes, I don't know how to pronounce, but they are huge things. They go down to like the aquifers beneath the water, and the Mayans used to sacrifice people there because they thought they were sort of sacred sort of places where you go to the underworld or something. And these days they're quite nice for diving, and also for diving underwater, but also
for spelunking.
Spelunking. And free jumping. Word. People love to
Is spelunking?
Spelunking is basically going into a cave.
Cave diving.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
My question is, so if you want to buy a house, you have it surveyed to check that there's no, you know, damp in the walls or whatever. Is there anything you can do about finding out whether or not it's built over a massive, scary hole?
Basically, no. Unless there happens to be some kind of, like, tunnelling work nearby and they happen to come across it. It's really bad. You can't do it. I mean, with a hurricane or any of the... Most natural disasters, even if you don't see it coming, there is a way to work out if it's coming. But sinkholes are just so widespread, it's impossible. I mean, in Florida, sinkholes have actually been attributed with slowing down the recovery of the housing market there, because the insurance premiums for houses at risk of sinkholes, which is like the whole state, are now so high they can run into thousands of dollars that it's making it hard for people to afford to buy houses.
Right, I'm going to file them in that case with spiders on things I can't do anything about, and therefore it's not worth worrying about. Thank you very much, Ian. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. We're produced by Philip Morn, and our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.